You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And our Berlin satellite and Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
In the Watford branch of the Cycling Podcast operation. This is our final podcast, chaps, before the Vuelta. It doesn't seem long since the Tour de France finished.
Well, it's not long. It's not long, is it, since the Tour de France finished?
Lionel, Watford made a good signing today, didn't they?
They did. They signed
the hipster's Neymar, I've heard.
Richarlison. A 20-year-old Brazilian striker. Yeah, snatched him from under the noses of Orica, who seemed to be signing everybody else this week.
That's enough. That's enough of that. I'm going to have to rein this back. We're talking about cycling this week in our final pre-Vuelta podcast. A reminder at this point, we will be coming nightly from the Vuelta on a sort of shift basis. I'm doing the first week with you, Lionel, and Daniel, you'll be there throughout. And I think, Lionel, you're missing the middle week and I'm missing the final week. But between us, we will bring you nightly podcasts and Kilometre Zero. And we'll be joined as well by Spanish journalist Fran Reyes as well. So he will be fulfilling the sort of Francois Tomaso role at the Vuelta.
Big shoes for Fran to fill there, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I think he's aware of that, but I'm very confident that he'll be more than up to the task. Very confident in Fran. Anyway, before we get on to talking about some other cycling, Lionel, can you give us the news roundup, please?
I certainly can, Rich. Lots to update people on from the world of cycling. The big news this week is that Alberto Contador has announced that he will retire at the end of the Vuelta a España next month, bringing to an end a career that we shall discuss in the final part a little bit, I think, of today's podcast. Sticking with the Vuelta, we've also heard that Adam Hansen, who's on this amazing run of 18 consecutive Grand Tours that he's completed, a stretch that goes back to 2011, he'd not been picked by Lotto Soudal for the Vuelta, which would have brought the run to an end. He'd been suffering with a saddle sore from the Tour de France, but because his teammate Rafael Valls has broken his hip in a training crash, Adam Hansen has been called up for Lotto Soudal, so his run will continue. There's been a lot of transfer moves this week, confirmed since the window has opened, not just Watford signing a Brazilian striker, but Alexander Kristoff is moving from Katusha to Team UAE Emirates. Warren Barguil is moving from Sunweb to Fortuno Oscardo. Daniel, the rumours were correct. He's making that quite surprising move. We'll discuss that a little bit later on. Then there's a
Stuffed
whole host
that up,
of...
Didn't I? Yeah.
Never mind. We can't get everything right. We aim for about 60% accuracy in the news roundup and the tale of the attack.
It's a bit of a high bar for us sometimes, I think.
Anyway, a lot of sort of very very good but kind of middle-ranking riders are moving as well. Tony Galopin, probably the best known of those. He's leaving Lotto Soudal to join AG2R. Mikel Nieve is going from Sky to Orica. Matteo Trentin's going from Quickstep to Orica. But leaving Orica are Magnus Cort Nielsen, who's off to Astana, and Jans Kuchelaer, who is off to Lotto Soudal. The merry-go-round kind of spins round and round, and a lot of the same teams are all involved in these transfers, because Jürgen Rolands is going from Lotto Soudal to BMC. BMC are also picking up Alberto Bettiol from Cannondale. That's quite a surprising transfer, but a good move for BMC. We'll maybe touch on that one when we talk about the transfers. Bora have signed Daniel Oss from BMC and Peter Kenyuk from Sky. And there's a few more riders on the move. Dimension Data are losing both Omar Frehley, who's going to Astana, and Nathan Haas, who is going to Katusha. So they're losing a couple of good riders there. But like I say, we'll talk about the transfers a little bit later on in the podcast. Something that we expect to be confirmed next week by RCS, the organiser of the Giro d'Italia, is that the 2018 Giro will start in Jerusalem and will then have two road stages in Israel before heading back to Italy. That hasn't been officially confirmed yet, but we suspect that that is certainly going to happen. Meanwhile, in the racing, the Tour of Poland was won by BMC's Dylan Tuns, who was third at Flesh Wallonne earlier this year. So that's another big result for their Belgian rider. In Poland, there are a couple of stage wins for Sky with Danny Van Poppel and Wout Poels, and a couple for Orica with Caleb Ewan and Jack Haig. Mikel Landa won the Tour of Burgos. There was the European Road Racing Championships as well. Alexander Kristoff won the men's road race. Victor Campenaerts won the time trial. And there was a Dutch double in the women's races with Marianne Vos winning the road race and Ellen van Dijk winning the time trial. And this week's racing mostly focuses on the Binkbank Tour, which was previously known as the Eneco Tour. And just as he did in Poland, Peter Sagan won the opening stage there. So the racing carries on. Next stop, the Vuelta a España, which starts in Nîmes a week on Saturday.
Indeed, yes. Did you watch much of the racing? I watched quite a lot of the Tour of Poland. Really enjoyed it. It was terrific racing, great countryside, fantastic roads. Not fantastic roads for driving or cycling for fun, but fantastic roads for racing. Quite rough in places, poor road surfaces. But I thought there was some great racing at the Tour of Poland.
Good fans, very passionate now, aren't they?
To be
fair, I think Poland has always had a pretty strong cycling culture that we've not always been terribly aware of, but it's found its outlet now with a lot of good Polish riders. Rafał Majka was prominent, he almost won the race, didn't he, on the last day. Questionable tactics perhaps from Sagan and Majka and Bora. Did they play that correctly on the last day? Sagan went on what looked like a bit of a kamikaze attack, and he wasn't much help to Majka in the end, was he, on the last day? But Toynes was incredibly strong. It was interesting to read his BMC world team managers and direct sportives talking after the race about whether we'd seen the emergence of a new Grand Tour star. The jury is very much out on that. Simply because he's very inexperienced or hasn't really shown much on long climbs up to this point, but certainly someone who, when we come to the Ardennes Classics next year and some more prestigious one-week stage races, I think.
And TJ Van Garderen was pretty impressive in support of Toynes at the Tour of Poland. I thought it was a good result. I mean, on BMC, Lionel, you mentioned Alberto Bettiol going to BMC. That took me by surprise. Anybody who listened to our friend special in the Cannondale Drapac team car at the Tour de France will be familiar with Bettiol. He really rode an outstanding tour. He was, I think, fifth on the stage to Longwy, which showed his talent. But throughout the race, he was a really strong support rider for Rigoberto Urán. A bit of a breakthrough performance for him. And he seemed, when I spoke to him, very happy at Cannondale. I think Cannondale thought he was happy there. So I think quite a few people taken by surprise with his move to BMC. And BMC don't have a great track record of developing talent, do they? Toynes might be an exception to that. Maybe Bettiol could follow a similar path and develop there. But there aren't great precedents.
Yeah, indeed, Rich. It'll be interesting to see what they do with Bettiol. He's a guy who's pretty versatile, quite a strong climber, can be a useful domestique, but also good in hilly one-day races in particular. He really did emerge in the sort of his last 18 months at Cannondale. I can remember speaking to people at Cannondale early in his career there, and they of course had inherited him from the disbanded Liquigas team, along with Morena Moser and Christian Corrin, and a couple of other, Corrin is not Italian, but the rest were Italians. And they were very, sceptical about how long and how well Bettiol was going to last. He really hadn't had any results. I remember he had he abandoned a lot of races in his first season as a professional. And he did look like one of those very good under-23 riders who was just never going to cut it at pro level, but has proved a lot of people wrong.
Well, let's carry on with transfer chat, because, as you said, Lionel, it has been a bit of a merry-go-round the last week. And one team that might look almost unrecognisable next year is Quickstep. They are losing a lot of riders. There seems to be, I mentioned last week that all of their riders are at contract at the end of the year, which is always going to make it difficult to keep them all together. But a few sort of riders who you would say are the backbone of the team, Julian Vermaat is off to Dimension Data. Matteo Trentin is off to Orica. Really interesting things happening at Orica. You can certainly see the direction they're going in, losing Magnus Cort Nielsen and Jens Kukkeler, and taking on guys that will really sort of bolster them in the Grand Tours. And rumours that Marcel Kittel will leave as well. They have signed Philippe Gilbert, but he is building a team, clearly, among that those young, very exciting riders, Jungels, Gaviria, Alaphilippe. Those three young guys in particular, all very different in terms of their talents. That's quite an exciting proposition. The challenge may be in putting the right riders around them to support them, because that's he's clearly losing those guys as well.
It's interesting, Rich, that he does seem to have gone very much with the future, or gone with the riders who in a year, 2 years, 3 years are likely to be winning big races. I've always thought of Lefebvre as a man who's very much in the present, and he's always sort of concentrated and focused on riders who, you know, can bring in results at the current moment, rather than taking punts on guys who with a lot of potential. But he's obviously got a lot of confidence in those few riders. The other very promising rider that Quickstep have, who was incredibly impressive at the weekend in Burgos, was Enric Mas, the Mallorcan climber who won the stage to Lagunas de Nea, the sort of iconic stage of that race, the Vuelta a Burgos. And he's someone who's been touted, certainly with Contador retiring this year, as a possible heir to Alberto Contador. For a long time, we thought that there was not much coming up in Spain behind Perito Rodriguez, Valverde, Contador. But all of a sudden, the next generation of Spanish stage racers in particular is looking quite strong, with David de la Cruz, also at Quickstep, Enric Mas, and there's another rider, Caja Rural, who's going to Movistar next year, Jaime Rosón. So it's suddenly looking quite healthy for the Spanish.
Yeah, and Quickstep are, you know, almost Belgian national team, but very few young Belgian stars on that team. Again, Gilbert's in his mid-30s now. Speaking of going missing, as you were a second or two ago, Daniel, anybody seen Lionel Burney? Is he still here?
I'm still here, Rich. I'm just listening to all this speculation about riders who might be good in the future. It's wonderful.
you just disappeared there, Lionel, but you're still here.
I've been just listening, being very attentive. Certainly what you say there about Enric Mas, I mean, he was a new name for me, watching him in the Vuelta a Burgos, you know, look very good. They rode almost in tandem, didn't they, De La Cruz and Mas? And when I looked him up, obviously realised he's only 22 years old. So you're absolutely right what you say about the Lefebvre kind of ripping up what he normally does, which is basically has stars who can all win right now. And looking to sort of refresh. But perhaps that's because, you know, the team, if they're signing a longer term sponsorship deal, they're going to be around for a bit. He's, you know, it's an opportunity that he's had sort of thrust upon him now, which he perhaps hasn't had the last two or three years with this uncertainty over the future of the team hasn't just been this year, has it? It's been the last 18 months to 2 years. So he would no doubt have gone for the bankers that are going to get him results in the moment, rather than looking to build anything.
Yeah, and the other thing with this sort of transfer period that started on the 1st of August is that I think so much comes down to timing as well. And when you're in a position like Lefebvre, he's probably had to, well, I think the majority of that team was out of contract, and he's had to have a lot of different conversations with a lot of different agents. And, you know, it may be that on a particular day, one agent has presented a particularly convincing case and Lefebvre has given his word, and then someone else comes along with an almost equally convincing case, but, you know, his hands are tied by that point, he's committed. I mean, you look now what's happened with Contador and Trek. I wonder when Trek found out or knew that Contador was going to retire. There was talk, I've seen talk today, that he had already made that decision in the middle of the Tour de France. But I can remember speaking to the Trek manager, Luca Guercellena, during the Tour de France, and he said, well, our budget next year is almost completely accounted for, and you know, there's no way we're going to be able to make any big signings. But that, of course, now you would think has changed. But is it too late to make a bid for example, Mikel Landa or Fabio Aru, both guys who'd be very useful for Trek, with Contador bowing out?
Well, rumoured today that Aru could be going to Trek. And, of course, Landa's agent manager was spotted chatting to Luca Guercellena at the end of the Tour de France. So who knows?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Science and Sport. They and Rafa ensure that we can cover the Grand Tours and produce weekly free episodes. We're very grateful indeed to them. And a reminder that you, the listener, can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products if you go to scienceandsport.com. There's a new code now. It's CPAUG20. That's CPAUG20. So at the checkout, scienceandsport.com, enter that code and you'll get 20% off. We must also tell you again about Science and Sport's Premier Delivery Service. If you sign up for that at £9.99, that gives you unlimited next day delivery, early access to new products, world-class nutrition advice, and a free gift worth £28. Go to scienceandsport.com/thecyclingpodcast. So we're talking at the end of the last part about the transfer merry-go-round, and in particular, Alberto Contador and when his team Trek Segafredo knew of his intention to retire at the end of the year. It was always a possibility, wasn't it, that this would be his final year. He was keeping his options open. I think he had an option on next year as well. But this was already an extra year for Contador because he had originally said he was going to retire at the end of last year, which was the inspiration for our Friends special on Alberto Contador, which came out a year ago. And we went ahead with that despite him deciding to carry on. But yeah, he's going. The Vuelta will be his last race. And I think you made a couple of points on Twitter, Daniel, when the news broke about his retirement, that he is the sort of rider who's not going to want to just fade gradually away, but go out in a blaze of glory. And it was obvious at the Tour that, you know, he's not capable anymore of doing the sorts of things in races that he was able to do just a couple of years ago.
I also think, I suppose the point I was trying to make as well was that he is someone who has got no interest, I don't think, in sort of fading into a secondary role and maybe becoming even quite a prized domestique and a valuable domestique. It's just not something that's in his DNA. He's someone who's been quite uncompromising, and I think part of his strength has been his single-mindedness, and we've talked before about how he comes into a team and he brings his whole entourage with him, and he almost creates this kind of enclave, this oasis, which is sort of self-sustaining. And it does tend to be very kind of, well, it's very Contador-centric, isn't it? He's not someone who has ridden as a domestique for, well, 10, 15 years now. It was only really the first year or two of his career when he had any experience of that. So I don't think that was ever really an option. And it surprised me to a certain extent because we did a little sit down, or I did a little sort of press gathering with him at the Dauphiné, and he was there very bullish, I would almost say delusional, about why he had not won the Tour de France for the last 5 or 6 years, because he reeled off this whole litany of reasons and excuses, and sort of everyone in the room was, I think, sitting there thinking, well, you know, it can't all have been bad luck, it can't all have been injuries, or you know, the crashes happened for a reason. And we've talked about this before with Contador in the last 3 or 4 years, that he has crashed an awful lot, and that is not something you generally see with the best stage racers when they're in their prime years. They generally are very sharp and very attentive and are always in the right positions, and it just, you know, these crashes, they were just piling up, and this bad luck was piling up, and it did seem to, well, they seem to be the hallmarks of a career that was slowly sort of waning, dwindling. But Contador was adamant that he could win the Tour de France this year, and he sounded like a man who was not even contemplating retirement, and in fact might well have carried on for 3 or 4 more years.
When you look at the spring he had, that would have given him an awful lot of confidence. A run of second places in the early stage races, Paris-Nice, Tour of Catalonia and the Tour of the Basque Country. But then when the level stepped up and everybody was, you know, at the Tour de France, it was obvious that you know, he wasn't in that same bracket anymore. Not for want of trying, though. There were a couple of days when, you know, he really did try and get himself up the road, and there was particularly the day when he was away with Quintana that looked like, I can't remember where that was now, but that was
Cherchevalley.
That's right.
The stage to Cherchevalley, when I was in the team car that day.
Yeah, and you know, there were glimpses, but I think, as we said during the Tour de France, that the glimpses were, you know, they were 6 to 8 pedal revs worth of the old Contador, that's all that was kind of really left. He wasn't able to put the distance between him and the others that he needed to do. He didn't have that acceleration, that zip. But then again, you know, he's nearly 35. So, I mean, it's a generalization, but the sort of the first thing that begins to go with athletes is the explosivity. You know, still have the durability, but his racing is all based on that ability to put a distance between him and everybody else and then just keep going, and that certainly isn't there anymore. And perhaps he got his season a little bit wrong, you know, very good early on, and then when it came to the Dauphiné and the Tour, he didn't quite have enough.
But still, Lionel performing incredibly well, relatively speaking. I mean, ninth in the Tour de France, not out of the question that he can win the Vuelta this year. But yeah, he wasn't even content to accept that over the next two or three years. He could easily have taken home, you know, a million and a half, maybe even 2 million euros a season for the next 2 years, and presumably still finished top 10 in a couple of Grand Tours, and maybe picked up the odd win in the smaller stage races, which I think are a real kind of unheralded aspect and dimension of his palmarès. Really, he's record in races like the Tour of the Basque Country and Castilla-León. These races absolutely phenomenal, and I suppose when in the final analysis, when people start to consider his place in the pantheon of professional cycling, that sort of compensates for his lack of success, really, or lack of presence, of any kind of presence whatsoever in one-day races. I mean, I did a quick tally yesterday, and I think he's raced in about 30 one-day races in his entire career. Did the World Championships 3 times, Lombardy a couple of times, Flèche Wallonne, I think he's in 4 or 5 times, but it's pretty much just completely ignored that whole side of the sport.
That's one of the questions that we were interested in when we did our Friends special a year ago. Given his, as you say, his explosiveness, his attacking instincts, it is surprising that he doesn't have at least one sort of big one-day race. Milano-Torino in 2012, I think it's the only one. But yeah, you may well have your head in your hands at that, Daniel. It is surprising. I mean, when you go back and you know you look at the tours that he's ridden since he coming back from his suspension, the one that got away, I think, is 2014. I mean, he would have given Nibali a real run for his money there, I think, had he not crashed out. That must be the one that he looks at and thinks that was a real opportunity. But it's interesting that you use the word delusional, Daniel, because...
Well, I said almost delusional. I can already see the tweets coming in.
Okay, no. But I'm not saying this in necessarily a negative way. Not delusional is perhaps the wrong word. But that day that I was in the Cannondale car with Ken Van Mark, the DS, and Contador bridged up to the breakaway and really went on the rampage that day in the way that only Contador can. Van Mark said that he'd been speaking to Trek staff the previous day, which was a rest day? No, it wasn't, but it was the previous day anyway, and he said that the Trek staff had said that Contador believed he could still win the Tour on those two big Alpine stages. He was 7 minutes down, I think, at that point, but he believed he could still win the Tour. That's what they said, with evident sort of disbelief themselves. But that, I guess, is the mentality that you need as an athlete and as somebody.
Absolutely. And we've seen that defiance. It's a common theme in the latter part of a lot of great careers in cycling and in other sports. I mean, Merckx was the same, carried on too long. I mean, the great merit of the decision that Contador has made is that you can't really say that this is a season too many, because, as I said, he has been very competitive throughout the season. And who knows, like I say, he could win the Vuelta. But yeah, certainly that defiance in the face of doubts and in the face of the evidence has been a characteristic. It's been a theme of the last couple of years of his career, I would say.
Who says a professional sport should be all about winning anyway? I mean, Contador bows out as a very, very popular rider indeed, even I would dare say loved by a lot of cycling fans. Had he gone out, you know, having won 5 Tours de France in a row, he wouldn't be popular. So there's a lot to be said for in the what we might call the second part of Contador's career, building that sort of career where he has given people a lot of excitement. I've mentioned that we did a friend special last year. We thought we'd play a little clip of that now. That's still available if you want to sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. If you sign up as a friend for 2016, you will have access to that and all the other specials that we did last year. It was about an hour and 45 minutes long, our Contador special. We had long interviews with Johan Bruneel, Michael Rasmussen, who he battled with for his first Tour de France win in 2007, his mechanic, Faustino Munoz, his teammate, Jesus Hernandez, longtime teammate and friend. And we spoke as well to Fran Reyes, the journalist who's joining us at the Vuelta. And Fran had a very interesting perspective on just how Contador became loved, I suppose, by the Spanish sporting public.
They loved him. I mean, Spanish public, they love Alberto Contador. He's the, you know, for 10 years, I've been riding my bike and being shouted, Indurain, you know? Everybody in Spain thought of a cyclist, and every time the first name that sprang to their mind, it was Miguel Indurain. But after Contador's positive test, it changed. Now they shout Contador. You know, they don't shout Valverde, they don't shout Samuel Sanchez, no, they shout Alberto Contador. Probably the turning point for his popularity in Spain, at least from my point of view, was his positive test. Because at that point, before that, he was just a sporting champion, you know, one of many, like Rafa Nadal, like Pau Gasol, like Fernando Alonso, okay? But after the positive test, he went on this tour through TV shows that usually feature only famous people, you know. But he went on that tour in order to introduce himself, explain his case, and say, hey, this is so unfair that I am being accused of doping because of this clenbuterol, of this minimal amount of substance, and blah, blah, blah. That, because of that, his popularity increased dramatically, and he was known by all Spanish people, not only by sports fans. Spain is a country that, historical-wise, has been losing for 400 straight years. You know, we have been losing territories, we have been losing wars and all that stuff. So we have this culture of forgiveness, also probably inherited from the Catholic moral. So we tend to have more empathy towards losers than towards winners, towards to those who are victims than towards those who have inferred that defeat to anyone else.
Your interview with his mechanic, Faustino, it was fascinating. Clearly very close to him, you know, he became quite emotional. But also, similarly, he echoed that sense, that view of him as a sort of victim, that he's been screwed by the system. He said, what did he mean by that?
Well, probably this thing of undergoing all these problems because of just being him, you know, because for some reason or another, the system was sympathetic towards him, you know. And so in the case of Faustino Munoz, he is more of a soldier than of a mechanic for Alberto. He's grown along with him. He doesn't only respect him or have a good professional relationship, he admires him deeply. So, yeah, I was surprised also when he got so emotional during the interview. But I think it was more or less on the same page that I was expecting of him as a person so close with such deep boundaries with Contador.
Well, Rich, Contador's career isn't quite over. He could win a fourth Vuelta later this month, and obviously next month the Vuelta ends in September the 10th, I think it ends, and that would equal Roberto Heras's official record. Heras has 4 Vuelta wins, although that's complicated, isn't it?
Because he was stripped
of one and then reinstated. So yeah, it's, when you look at Contador's career, 3 Vuelta wins, 3 Giro wins, but stripped of one of those titles, 2011, when he won the race fairly convincingly, but then had it taken away as a result of the positive test for clenbuterol, which was arose from a sample taken, I think, on the rest day of the 2010 Tour de France. So he was also stripped of that 2010 Tour title. So officially, Contador has 2 Tour wins, not 3. And it's interesting, Fran Reyes there saying that Contador's popularity in Spain was heightened by the doping ban. He obviously had to sit out on the sidelines for a couple of years. He was stripped of those results. Well, he didn't sit out for a couple of years, did he? But he was stripped of those results. And then came back and picked up more or less where he left off by winning the Vuelta. And it was one of those cases, wasn't it, where he claimed that the clenbuterol, which was the banned substance that was in his urine sample, had got into his body as a result of contaminated food. And it was a story that ran and ran. And because the evidence against Contador was such that the traces of clenbuterol were very, very small, there were people who gave him the benefit of the doubt, but not enough of the benefit of the doubt for him to retain those Grand Tour titles. So, I mean, how do we evaluate his career now, knowing that, he came back and he won three Grand Tours after the dope test, positive dope test, and three before? I mean, do we almost evaluate his career as one of two halves?
Well, it was interesting, Lionel. I thought watching the World Athletics Championship over the weekend or over the past few days, it was almost like watching professional cycling as it was 20 years ago. I think athletics is going through now a lot of what cycling did around about the time of the Festina scandal. But of course, that brought into focus the complicated business of, well, knowing how to deal with former dope cheats or former convicted dopers. I'm talking particularly about the 100-meter sprint, which was won by Justin Gatlin, who actually, he's failed two tests, hasn't he? One of them was, you could say it was fairly similar to Contador's clenbuterol positive, quite a contentious one. The other one was a bit more clear-cut. But, Contador is sort of emblematic of this generation that had one foot in the bad old days and one foot in the kind of brave new world, as we discussed a few weeks ago, it's very difficult to know what's happening in professional cycling because we are deprived of, there aren't many positive tests, there are not many investigations, there's not that much coverage of the doping issue anymore, which is in stark contrast to athletics, where it's very easy at the moment, I think, to get quite a clear picture of what's happening in athletics by virtue of documentaries, positive tests, and so forth and so forth. But in the last few years in cycling, when Contador has continued to win and continued to be very successful, it has been quite difficult to know at large what has been going on in professional cycling and who are the riders who are thriving or whether they are clean and whether they're legitimate champions. But in the absence of any evidence, clear evidence to the contrary, we've had to take achievements like Contador's in the second half of his career at face value and acknowledge that he has been certainly one of the best riders of the last 15 years without any doubt, and maybe one of the best riders in the last 50 years. But it's perfectly understandable, and I don't think Contador can have any problem with people putting a rather large asterisk by his whole career, because the stain of that positive clenbuterol test does remain, and as well as other sort of links more or less tenuous with doctors, coaches who have been discredited,
and teams, of course. I guess an alternative, more optimistic, maybe rose-tinted view of his career would be to say that he thrived in two different eras as well, that he was one of the best riders in two different eras. If we, as you say, Daniel, take at face value the widely held or widely believed view that the culture in cycling did change at a certain time, then Contador was one of the dominant riders in an earlier era and one of the dominant riders in a later era. It's very difficult and very complicated because a lot of people will tell you that the culture changed around 2008, 2009, but his positive test, of course, was in 2010 in the Tour de France, and that is as unclear-cut as doping cases come. A lot of us will have read the Court of Arbitration for Sport ruling on it, where it was clear that they couldn't even decide actually what had happened with that. There were various theories, and really, unfortunately, it was very murky, and it does, ironically, throw into sharp focus a dilemma that all of us journalists and cycling fans have when looking at somebody like Alberto
and
Contador.
Rich, when we start talking about his place in the Hall of Fame, you know, we are comparing him, we are speaking about Contador in terms of where he ranks against Merckx and Anquetil and so forth, who, of course, were also implicated in doping cases. Merckx tested positive three times. Anquetil was quite transparent, really, about how he felt about doping, and that he felt that it had a part to play in the life of professional cyclists. And, you know, the same applies to Fausto Coppi and various other sort of, the most illustrious names in professional cycling history. So it would be a bit disingenuous to suggest that Contador is disqualified from that conversation by virtue of one positive test. Unfortunately, we wish they were all clean, of course, but...
Well, I think that's the important point, Rich, because we don't know the circumstances. We don't know, we still don't know, almost 7 years after the news of the positive test from the 2010 Tour came out. We're still none the wiser how the substance clenbuterol got into Contador's body. He can maintain that it was from some steak that had been brought to him on the rest day to eat, which, you know, experts will say, well, that is a possibility, particularly given the size of the traces in that were found in his samples. But then the other theory was that because clenbuterol is a substance that can be used to strip fat and help a rider lose weight, there was a theory that perhaps the substance was in a blood bag that he'd he'd used, and neither were proven one way or the other. The fact of the matter were that the rule of strict liability meant that the substance, being not naturally occurring, was in his system, and the rules are, if it's in the system, then you face a suspension, and his results were voided. But we still don't know from Contador or anyone around Contador exactly what happened, and I think until we do know the circumstances for sure, which we probably never will, it's very difficult to evaluate his career and decide, you know, where we place him. But Daniel, as you say, you know, this is not Alberto Contador is not the only high profile rider to have asterisks against his victory, not by a long chalk.
All we can really say is that in the recent past, when he has raced with the biological passport, when there has been more testing, more scrutiny, where certainly it has been more difficult, if not impossible, for teams to run, you know, systematic doping programs, Contador has been an outstanding rider and an attacking rider who has animated lots of races.
No, absolutely. He's been one of he's probably been the greatest entertainer of the last 10 years, certainly in major tours. And this is something that it became clear in that conversation I referred to at the Dauphiné. He has become aware of and has started to embrace as well in recent times. He's realized that one of the things, or maybe the thing, that people have appreciated most about his career has been that attacking style. And he started to relish that. And he even admitted, you know, going back and watching videos of himself on YouTube, which we all do, of course. But I think that is probably, I don't need to tell Vincenzo Nibali and Chris Froome this, but I think it's probably ominous in view of the Vuelta. I'm sure that Contador's got one last flourish up his sleeve. I don't think he'll win the race, but there will be a stage, and it will probably be quite telegraphed. Everyone will know what day it's going to be, in the same way that the Tour de France, everyone looked at the profile of the stage to Foix, the 100-kilometer stage, and they said this is exactly the kind of day where all hell is going to break loose because of Contador. And it will be the same at the Vuelta. There will be a day which everyone will have circled in red, and that will be the Contador day.
I mean, let's not forget the way he raced last year effectively helped Nairo Quintana win and help put Chris Froome on the back foot. I mean, that was Contador, you know, the bike racer, wasn't it? And I think you're right, Daniel. We'll see something in his last race. But I have to say, you know, it's I find it harder to separate the kind of the entertainment factor and the possible reality of and the question marks. It's hard to revel in it and enjoy it quite so much. And I know that's it's almost impossible to unpick every performance and say, is what I'm seeing here real? But I agree with you, the World Athletics Championships this week has kind of it's reminded me of the kind of the battle, the grapple for sense, the grapple to make sense of a sport, that we've kind of gone through over the last 15 odd years covering it. It's very hard to say, and people ask all the time, what do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about that race, that performance? And very often the only answer we can give is, well, I don't really know. And I think athletics are still, a lot of people who are watching it and commentating on it perhaps are trying to provide answers where perhaps the most sensible thing would be to say, we don't know what the answers are here. We may not know for another generation.
In the absence of too many answers, unfortunately, the issue is simplified, isn't it? And it would be wrong to hold Contador up as a devil, as a symbol of evil, if you like, in the same way that it's wrong to hold up Justin Gatlin, the sprinter, in that way. The issue, it's murky, as I said earlier.
I agree with your point there, Rich, about the unfairness, if you like, of holding someone who got caught up as kind of the poster boy, if you like. He becomes the lightning rod, and he's not the only one. There are others. There have been others over the last decade. The people who carry the can, if you like, for the rest of the sport, when we suspect that there may well be others who are operating in the shadows and who don't attract the same level of criticism, the same sort of sceptical or cynical comments about their performances. But unfortunately, I mean, what else do you do? How do you evaluate somebody's performances when you have in one column the results and you have in the other column the positive test and the question marks about how that positive test arose? It's a very difficult one, and it's one we grapple with all the time. And I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong answer here, but I personally just find it harder to look at the athletic performance without looking in the other column and seeing the results that were stripped away from him.
Hi, I'm Sarah Clark, Chief Marketing Officer at RAFA. We have a very vibrant, young, energetic organisation. I think people look to us to keep pushing boundaries and to keep pushing the sport forward. And we try to do that in lots of different ways, obviously with the products that we create for people to wear, the content that we create to really inspire people to get onto their bikes. And a lot of people know this already, but we're very lucky. We give people until lunchtime on Wednesdays to go and get a long ride in, because that's very important for people to clear their minds and come back in with a really positive frame of mind. But it also means that they can test our products, because we're all ingrained cyclists at heart, so it allows them to sort of keep living the sport and keep living our product in the best way possible.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you, of course, to our main headline sponsor, RAFA. Extremely grateful to them for their continued support. I mentioned earlier that their support, along with Science and Sports, enables us to bring you all these podcasts and to travel to and cover the Grand Tours. The Vuelta is just around the corner. We're going to preview that in a moment or two. But
been a good week for RAFA, hasn't it, Rich?
It's been a good week for RAFA.
for our chums at RAFA.
Yeah, the good friends at RAFA. A reminder that if you want to swell...
are we going to explain that? We should explain.
Well, go ahead, Lionel. It should have been in your news roundup.
Well, I did consider it, but it's not really to do with professional racing, is it? But RAFA has been purchased by some very wealthy people who are they're part of the Walmart dynasty, but it's not Walmart the company that has purchased RAFA, but it's around about a £200 million deal. Probably should have been in the transfer news, really, shouldn't it?
I don't know about that. But yeah, I think we're only getting about 10% of that, aren't we?
Are we part of the package?
I don't know, actually. I haven't studied the small print. But
I think we are part of the package. The price was going to be $250 million, but they chucked us in as well.
If you want to swell RAFA's coffers further and also help us, then do go online and buy a t-shirt. Or, well, the cycling jerseys are temporarily out of stock, but they will be restocked soon. Pedler Ducharme jersey, but the caps and the t-shirts are available, and we will be going, of course, with t-shirts to the Vuelta to present them to our Pedlers Ducharme at the Vuelta. They're available at rafa.cc or through the cyclingpodcast.com, through our shop. You can link to the Rafa website and buy your t-shirts there. Well, I'm going to take an extra one, actually. I'm hoping Thomas de Gendt is going to ride the Vuelta. He's on the long list at the moment, but he was a late Pedler Ducharme at the Tour de France for having been overlooked for the Combativity Award. He somehow scandalously lost out to Warren Barguil there. But yeah, we'll present him with a Pedler Ducharme t-shirt by way of consolation. And we'll be obviously taking nominations and voting for our Pedlers Ducharme at the Vuelta. Who knows, maybe. Well, I was going to say Alberto Contador, but of course Contador already won it. He won it at the Tour de France. I don't know if you can win it twice in 1 year. Esteban Chavez posted a picture of himself wearing the old t-shirt yesterday. Maybe he'll be looking for one of the new ones at this year's Vuelta. Who knows? But
shameless hint that was, wasn't it?
From Chavez. It was a little bit.
10 days before the start of the Vuelta, post a picture of himself on a Pedler Ducharme t-shirt.
Absolutely classic tactic. That hey, speaking of Chavez, I'm looking forward to seeing Orica at the Vuelta. I don't know what sort of shape he's going to be in. He obviously wasn't in great form at the Tour, having had a very, very difficult year. But it's the first Grand Tour in which he will be lining up for Orica with both Yates brothers, Simon and Adam. And that is quite a tantalising prospect.
It is. They've all got on very well up until this point, as you would hope of twin brothers, Adam and Simon. But They've always raced, whatever combination of the three have raced together, they've always done it very harmoniously in Grand Tours up to this point. But they've never gone in with all three of them, or certainly with all three of them having pretty lofty ambitions. I think Simon's just going to go for stage wins. But how he reconciles that with the general classification ambitions of Chavez, if he still has any, Chavez, after his difficult Tour de France, and certainly Yates does have general classification ambitions, and that's going to be interesting to see, I think.
There's a lot that is interesting to see. The fact Romain Bardet is on the start list, this will be the first time that he's ridden two Grand Tours in a season. I don't think he's going there to try and finish on the podium necessarily, but it's all part of his development, kind of, I guess, toughening up process. Get through two Grand Tours in a summer. It may stand him in better stead next year. Fabio Aru will be there leading Astana. It'd be interesting to see just what sort of shape he's in. And Vincenzo Nibali leading Bahrain Merida. It's difficult to look past the likes of Aru, Nibali and Chris Froome, though, for the overall victory. I'm not sure what you chaps think.
No, I think so. There's quite a bit of pressure on Bahrain and Nibali. I think they've not had a fantastic first season. They will point out that I think no team had got a podium finish in a Grand Tour in their first year of existence for, well, this is the first team in 20 years to do that. So that's a big feather in their cap. They had a terrible Tour de France. It was interesting listening to or reading an interview from one of the direct sportifs, Philippe Mordoui, after the Tour, saying that they'd got their preparation all wrong. They'd done an altitude camp just before the Tour and their workloads had been all wrong. And there were no results to show, really, from that. And if you speak to Chiro,
they also lost their leader on day one, remember?
Yeah. And they've had a couple of sort of body blows like that. And if you speak to Chiro, he's not sure how happy Nibali has been with some of his domestiques this year and some of the support that he's had, and he's kind of, Nibali, I think he's putting a bit of pressure on the management to make some signings, guys to support him in whichever major tours he decides to do next year. So yeah, a little bit of pressure on Nibali, I would suggest.
And we shouldn't forget as well Chris Froome, who's going to the Vuelta really determined to win. I mean, this was what we were told was the explanation for his slow start to the year, and the fact that he went to the Tour without having won a race. He's still not won a race, as in crossed the line first. I mean, he has obviously won the Tour de France, which is quite a big race, but He didn't win an individual stage. I don't know. Froome tends to back up pretty well at the Vuelta. He's not won it, but he's gone very, very close. It was arguably a sort of tactical blunder that cost him the race last year. I think he's the favourite for it, don't you reckon? He's going with a pretty strong Team Sky team, and I think I've got him pegged as a favourite for the race. It's clearly one that he is desperate to win.
Yeah, I think he's very much the favourite, Rich. They will have a strong team. At the Vuelta last year, I got the impression that he didn't want to go into a Vuelta again with a team that was, well, such an ad hoc bunch, really, as it was last year. It was a sort of mix of riders who had not had many opportunities that year, or riders who had missed out on selection for the Tour de France. And I got the impression that Froome wanted to create a much more solid block around him for the Vuelta this year, and he seems to have done that. I think they're in the Alps at the moment doing a training camp, and of course they've got Wout Poels, who's not really raced very much at all this season. He's been out injured and was very, very strong in Poland, won stage there. So I think they're going to be really strong. I actually saw some quotes from one of the director sportifs, Dario Cioni, yesterday, I think, to the effect that Mikel Landa might take part, and that would be his third Grand Tour of the year. I understand that is probably erroneous. I don't know whether he was misquoted or he'd got the wrong end of the stick, but probably the former. And I think it's going to be, well, it's very, very unlikely is what I've heard, that Landa will take part. King Kenny, of course. King Kenny, he might.
Well, I was going to ask you if King Kenny was on. Yeah, I mean, King Kenny rode pretty well last week. Yeah, he rode all right. I did see a long list for the Theo Gegenhardt was on the long list. I don't expect him.
He's got to get back. Hasn't he got to get back for Freshers Week in September?
Oh dear, sorry Theo. I'm just looking at the I'm looking at the long list now for Team Sky. I mean, there's a couple of riders there who I'm absolutely sure are not going. Gianni Moscon and Theo Gegenhardt, and indeed Mikel Landa, which does leave, I think, about nine: Philip Dignan, Chris Froome, Peter Kenyuk, David Lopez, Mikel Nieve, Wout Poels, Diego Rosa, Ian Stannard, and Kenny Elissonde. I would imagine those are the nine riders who will line up for Team Sky.
Why not Moscon?
Well, I was told earlier in the year that he wouldn't ride a Grand Tour this year, but that might have changed. I don't know. But that's what I was told around the time of his unfortunate incident where he was obviously sat on the sidelines for a couple of months or 6 weeks after his he did make a racist comment, or he wouldn't have been punished for it, towards Kevin Reza, the FDJ rider. So he's back racing, and he's obviously, he rode extremely well in Burgos. I can't remember if he was Poland or Burgos. He rode extremely well in Burgos, but and that might have changed it. It might. He may well ride. I don't know. In which case, maybe King Kenny would lose out. I don't know. We'll wait and see.
I understand the decision is going to be made on King Kenny and whether he's going to be in the team in the coming hours. So stay tuned.
Really? The coming hours?
Yeah.
Well, probably be out by the time this podcast comes out. Anyway, we've got some other business, have we not, chaps?
A brief bit of other business, yeah. These reports mentioned by Napalm, I think, in his roundup. These reports that the Giro next year is going to start in Jerusalem. It's going to be a grande partenza, the big start. Don't know what big start is in Hebrew, but anyway, that it's going to start in Jerusalem of all places.
Well,
which is going to be contentious, isn't it?
This is almost certain. François Tomazo, our colleague during the Tour de France, said that this was definitely going to happen, and it was reported by some other outlets during the tour, wasn't it? So yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. It's the quest for, well, the Giro have been more ambitious with the taking the start away from the home country. It's been in Denmark, it's been in the Netherlands a few times, of course Northern Ireland with the Belfast start in 2014. But this is, well, Israel, it's a quite a long flight. It's logistically challenging for everybody involved, and it's interesting to say the least, isn't it?
Well, it's very contentious, isn't it? Particularly with two teams with the Palestinian question and two teams hailing from the Gulf, so Arab states effectively due to take part, so the UAE team and Bahrain. I understand that Bahrain have no real problem with this and they're looking forward to the start if it is in Jerusalem, if it does prove to be in Jerusalem. There'll be no... If anyone was thinking that there might be a boycott of by either of those teams, Bahrain certainly will not be partaking in that. I'm not sure about the UAE, but I know that both the UAE and Bahrain are pretty sort of sensitive to cultural, religious, political norms in their countries of origin. For example, during the Tour de France, I was doing a little feature on wine and wanted Diego Ulisi, who's a big wine buff, to take part. And he originally agreed, but then got cold feet at the last moment. I think having spoken to the team management, because of course alcohol is not freely consumed. Rich, I'm going to ask you now, because we've had a bit of a discussion off air about this. Is it banned, or it's certainly not something...
It's not something that is tolerated in Muslim cultures, is it, alcohol? You can obviously buy it in some of the fancy hotels in some of those countries, but it's not part of Muslim culture, no.
There you go. Well, this led me to believe that the idea, the prospect of a start in Israel might have caused some problems for, well, one or both of those teams. Doesn't appear to be the case, but the issue of sporting boycotts in Israel or sporting boycotts of Israel has been certainly broached in other sports before. There was a Kenyan-born naturalized Bahraini marathon runner a few years ago who went to compete in Israel and was subsequently stripped of his Bahraini citizenship. There's a group in the UK called Red Card Israeli Racism who campaign or try to create awareness about what they believe are human rights abuses in Israel, and they campaign for Israeli football teams or football tournaments to be boycotted. There's a bit of a history, a recent history of, and particularly athletes and teams from Iran boycotting teams or matches against or Israeli teams or opponents or in Israel. So it's certainly something that people have thought about and been concerned about before, and may well cause a bit of controversy if this announcement is made and as we get closer to the time.
I mean, there aren't many major sporting events, international sporting events, that happen in Israel and start in Jerusalem, are there? So the announcement is going to be significant, but the fact of it happening, you know, when it comes around, it's going to be a big event. And obviously this is why the Giro is doing it. It's going to attract a lot of attention, a lot of interest, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I'm sure RCS will be keen to paint it and portray it as something that will ultimately, you know, bring people together and perhaps even, you know, help the peace process in Israel. And I'm sure that not everyone is gonna buy that and be wholly convinced by that.
No, this is about tourism, isn't it, from the Israeli point of view, surely. I mean, you know, that's the reason that they would be interested in this and interested in hosting the Giro. And I think sports record generally on, sports governing bodies from the IOC right the way down, you know, they try to keep their sports politically neutral, or that's at least, you know, what they say. They say, well, it's not the role of sport to be judgmental about these things, but... it means that there are going to have to be some sensitive footsteps taken, I suspect, not least because you have two teams that are sponsored by nations that effectively don't want Israel to exist.
No, absolutely, Lionel. I mean, Jerusalem is, of course, a place that is claimed by both the Israelis and the Palestinians as their capital. So it is a place of huge symbolism, but also it's a contentious place. And as the date draws nearer to the, what is it, the big start, they call it, it's going to, their interest is going to ratchet up, and it is going to get a lot of attention. Now, obviously, that is the intention of the Giro and of Israel. Well, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Giro is all about, a big part of its, you know, drive in recent years has to be to put itself on the map. It's competing with the Tour de France, you know, so the start in Belfast was obviously part of that. And this is taking it a stage further. It's also going to have huge logistical challenges as well, you know, the long flight from there to Italy.
It'll be interesting to see as well, Rich, what they do with the route. The rumours are that they're going to be three stages, or a prologue and or a team time trial, and three and two other road stages. And of course, the sort of the contentious geographical areas in, or the disputed territories in Israel, they're not restricted to one city or one particular portion of land. There are a few of them. So, I'm sure it will have been, or it will prove to be, a very difficult balancing act if RCS decide to go ahead with this.
It certainly puts into perspective, you know, wrangling over, you know, how to think about cyclists who've been suspended for doping. I mean, this is, you know, much more contentious ground, and probably ground that we should look into in more depth and more detail once the announcement is officially made.
Absolutely, Lionel. I'm looking forward to your kilometre zero on the topic already. That'll be worth tuning into. Anyway, we should wrap things up for there. The next time you hear from us, we'll be in the Spanish city of Nîmes for the start of the Vuelta. And we're looking forward to that immensely. I can't wait, actually. I am looking forward to it. I've missed bike racing. So we're looking forward to getting to Nîmes and kicking off our coverage of the Vuelta. The three of us will be there, and we'll be joined by Fran Reyes, who we heard from in this episode as well. So that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.